It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. They say the most important piece of safety equipment outdoors is your brain. And that is particularly true with staying alive in avalanche country. Sliding snow is the most dangerous natural hazard in the backcountry, and knowledge is the most important tool to stay safe. Avalanche prediction is a big part of that, and so is the education that allows backcountry users to be ready for what they'll face. We'll talk about how to recognize danger, how to prepare for winter travel in the backcountry, and how to deal with disaster, and when to stay home. All that today on Outdoor Explorer with two expert, knowledgeable guests who are going to be teaching me a lot, because this is an area that I've always wanted to know more about. Kevin Wright is here. He's the director of the Avalanche Information Center, which is associated and part of Chugach National Forest. Thanks for being with me, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
And Aleph Johnston Bloom teaches avalanche awareness at the Alaska Avalanche School. Thanks for being with us, Aleph.
Thanks for having me as well.
So what is the most important thing that you begin teaching people when you are teaching them to be avalanche aware or prepared to go into the backcountry on their own?
I would say the foundation of what we teach people is how to actually recognize if they're in avalanche terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So are they actually underneath or around a slope that is capable of producing a slide?
And what's the, I mean, is it just steepness? Is that the main factor?
That is the main criteria. And so most avalanches occur between 30 and 45 degrees. And so having people actually start to calibrate their eyes to picking those slopes out.
Uh-huh. So under 30 degrees, it's not steep enough for this for it to get started. And over 45, it just falls off before it accumulates? Is that sort of
And so that's a general range. You know, especially here in Alaska where snow can be heavier and wetter, it can stick to those steeper slopes and be what we call a slab avalanche, mm-hmm. and I'm sure we'll talk more about that today. Mm-hmm. So you can have slabs on some steeper slopes, but you're correct, it does tend to slough off. And then at lower than 30 degrees, most of the time the stresses of gravity and the weaknesses aren't great enough. We still have folks exercise caution at angles below that, but the main ones we want folks to recognize is that 30 to 45.
So you didn't say the most important thing is how to find somebody who has been covered up by an avalanche. Explain.
So we definitely teach about avalanche rescue in our courses, but we really want we don't want people to be getting caught in avalanches. So as you said, right at the start, people using their brains to recognize the hazard and in many ways avoid it.
And I remember, you know, you mentioned Jill Fredston is one of the founders of the school. And I remember a statistic that she cited about this, the probability, the number of people that the rescuers actually are able to find alive if they're not found right away by their people who are with them. If people have to come from somewhere else to rescue someone, they're most likely not going to find them alive. Is that true?
That's true. It's you only have a very short amount of time to survive under the snow. Generally, we think about 30 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. And so that's why teaching companion rescue in our courses is also emphasized.
Yeah. So Kevin Wright from the Avalanche Information Center, what's your mission at the center? What are you trying to accomplish?
Our mission, besides also contributing to the education with the community, we do some free avalanche education workshops to the public. And then we also provide an avalanche forecasting product, which it displays a danger rating on basically a five-level scale from low danger to extreme danger, somewhere along that spectrum. And then it also goes pretty in-depth into describing the specific hazards that might be present on a given day and how to avoid them, what to look for, all the details that are pertinent for somebody who's to go into the backcountry.
Mm-hmm. And what does one stand for and what does five stand for in terms of what people should be aware of or what sort of people should be out there? I mean, when you say that avalanche danger is extreme, you're essentially saying just don't go? Or
yeah, so there's very specific criteria on this scale. If you're dealing with an extreme avalanche danger day, which is actually very rare, the best advice is people shouldn't be out in the backcountry. They shouldn't be traveling in the mountains at all. And that's one of those rare cases. It doesn't even happen every year where it's even likely that the road's going to be closed because avalanches have come down and made driving unsafe. Mm-hmm. When you get down a level to, say, high or considerable or moderate, that's the middle spectrum where there's more interpretation and more hazard management to be done. And that's generally where people get themselves into trouble, is there are ways to manage the hazard, and people want to get out there and have a good time. But there's also a danger, and they may find it.
Mm-hmm. And then low just means don't worry about it.
We never say don't worry about it.
Okay, well, in July.
Sure. And that's actually a really good point, because the only time there's no danger whatsoever is when there's no snow on the ground. But if there is snow on the ground, then we call it low. And we just tell people to take standard precautions. So basically, still watch out for the warning signs and take the standard rescue gear, because people still do find trouble in the low hazard days. The problem is just so complicated that we can't predict every single situation that you might encounter out there.
Well, that's one of the things that struck me about this, was that every slope is different, you know, and the National Forest is huge. And there's a lot of places where people could be. So I would think that would be, your lawyer would want to have you put a lot of weasel words in your prediction about what the level of hazard is, because it could be quite different in the same day in different places.
This is very true. And if you read the advisory, if you read some of the language that's written into those danger ratings, you kind of leave yourself room for running into problems even on the low danger day. And that's something that we all need to keep in mind. You know, even on the perfect hot weather, sunny day in Alaska in the summer, you can still run into problems. You got to be prepared for something that you didn't foresee. And the same is absolutely true in avalanche prediction and management.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about avalanches today on Outdoor Explorer, and I have two experts in the room. You're just hearing from Kevin Wright, who's the director of the Avalanche Information Center. And I also have Aleph Johnston Bloom, who's executive director of the Alaska Avalanche School. So both of you should contribute to this, but let's go over sort of the types of hazards, the types of avalanches that are there and what the main ways that they can be set off. Do you want to start with that, Aleph?
Sure. It's actually, in the last couple of years, the industry has really tried to define different types of avalanches to help people understand different hazards. And so we start off pretty basically in classes teaching people about either loose snow avalanches that start just in a point and spread out from there. That's just a loss of cohesion in the upper layers. And then we teach people about slab avalanches, and which is a cohesive piece of snow breaking out almost like a pane of glass and shattering.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the relationship of that slab to whatever's underneath it. And so we teach that, and we talk about different kinds of slabs.
So which type of these two that you've just mentioned is more hazardous or more important to know about, or equal?
Slab avalanches are definitely the avalanches that catch and kill more people.
Mm-hmm.
Loose snow also have hazards as well, especially depending if you end up underneath them, say in a small gully where they can pile up really deeply, or if you're on an ice climb. But we really focus on slab avalanches and recognizing if there's the potential of a slab avalanche.
Okay.
And you can have slab avalanches that are caused, we talk about wind slabs, we talk about hard slabs, which are harder, more cohesive pieces of snow, deep slabs, so big, large avalanches, persistent slabs that last for a very long time, cornice fall, ice fall.
And a cornice is a sort of a curl of snow or ice that goes over the top of a ridge.
And so all those pieces of avalanches are things we teach about, and then Kevin talks about in his forecast.
Mm-hmm.
And part of what we teach about is being able to understand what the forecasters are saying and understand what these specific problems are like.
So, Kevin, the issue when we're talking about slab avalanches, the issue of stability is about what's underneath it, right? Or is it more about the strength of the slab itself, or both?
It's the relationship. basically, you have to have both components for a slab avalanche to happen. The slab itself has to be somewhat more dense or stronger than the underlying layer, which is the weak layer we talk about. So the failure actually happens at the weak layer. There's almost always a collapse component where that weaker, looser, less dense snow gets collapsed, and then the overlying slab, like Olive said, sort of shatters like a pane of glass, and you get a wider mass of snow coming down all at once.
That sounds like it would be pretty complex to recognize it without some effort to actually dig through it and see what's under there. And I know we have a video on the website. There's actually, for folks who want to check it out, there's quite a bit of information on the website at alaskapublic.org, and just click on avalanche safety, and some pictures and links to the folks I'm talking to. But part of it is a video that Kevin contributed that's looking at how you actually do this testing of the strength of the snow. And folks should look at it. It's pretty interesting about you create a column and then you press down on it and see if it breaks. And explain how you do that.
Yeah, so when we're out in the field in the backcountry and looking for some of these signs and symptoms of unstable snow, sometimes it's actually fairly easy to recognize unstable conditions. And we talk about the standard five red flags in basic avalanche awareness, the top one being recent avalanche activity. And if you're going out there, even if you're just driving out to a trailhead, mm-hmm. you want to be looking up above you and looking for those signs of recent avalanche activity. If you do see that, if you know it's happening as you're out there, or if it happened in the last 24 hours, that's a pretty bullseye clue that you're going to encounter unstable snow.
Right.
When you get farther in time away from those events, then the equation gets a little bit more difficult. And that's where we get into the snow pit testing, like is in the video there. Mm-hmm. And it actually takes a lot of practice to get good at this, but I would never discourage anybody from getting down and digging pits and trying to understand the layering structure and the strength relationships between the layers.
It seems like there'd be a lot of craft and experience to that before you knew how to recognize what you were seeing.
There is, absolutely. And, the best way to start out understanding that process is to take a comprehensive avalanche course, mm-hmm. like with the Alaska Avalanche School, and they go through the process in those courses. But basically, as in the video there, what I'm doing is an extended column test. So you dig a pit into the snow, and you isolate on all four sides a column of a standard length and width. In this case, it's a 30 centimeter by 90 centimeter test column. And then you basically put force on it until it fails. Or if it doesn't fail, then that's an indication that the snow, at least in that place, is going to be fairly stable. If it does fail from the force that you exert on it, then you kind of want to figure out why it failed, where it failed, what the character of the failure was. And that gives you a whole lot of more information about the general stability around you.
And that's how you make these predictions. You go out and do these pits and then interpret.
That's one piece of the puzzle, yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's probably a lot more to it. But from the point of view of just somebody who wants to go skiing or out on their snow machine, how much of this knowledge do they need? I mean, do you need to know how to dig a snow pit and do the whole thing?
So we teach that as really just part of our classes. Mm-hmm. And a big part of it is collecting observations as they go. And those kind of bullseye clues is really what we emphasize. Because a lot of times there are these clues out there that are actually pretty obvious, but people get so excited about being out there, they're not even looking for those. So mm-hmm. we really want people to pay attention, look around, feel the snow, those kind of things.
So Kevin mentioned the clue about looking for other avalanches, which is a somewhat obvious. Yeah. Give us some more.
So you could have shooting cracks as you're traveling, and that indicates that there's a failure happening. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call a bullseye clue. You can have whoomphing, which is kind of doesn't sound that technical,
but it's actually, again,
a collapsing of a weak layer. And
if you hear it, then unless you have no nerves in your body, it's scary.
Yeah,
it is.
And then we also are wanting folks to look for recent heavy load, so heavy storm. Mm-hmm. That's just a red flag that there's more load onto the existing snowpack.
So there might be a weak layer and then a slab, and now a bunch of snow has been put on top of that slab, and so it's putting more stress on it so it could break away.
And that's really when we're out digging around and looking at the snow, we're always trying to see what's the existing structure like and do we think it can handle a load. We're mm-hmm. looking for that weak layer slab combination. I kind of like to think about it as like a good cake or a bad cake. Uh-huh. I like cake that has nice dense cake with the frosting on top, but a bad cake would be upside down. You have the dense with the frosting below. And I'm always out there looking for bad cake.
Okay. So how long does it take somebody to learn enough so that they can lead their family or lead their group? What's the process to get there? I mean, you don't have to have a PhD.
No. And that's what we're saying is we want folks to come and take what we call a level one avalanche class. And that gives a pretty broad spectrum amount of information that we think folks can then use to make good decisions out there. And we also teach about the fact that it's not that much information, and we want people to continue going out and looking at snow. Mm-hmm. But we teach conservative, safe protocols, basically.
Mm-hmm. And how long does the course take?
It's a 3-day course, uh-huh. and it covers avalanche terrain, weather, decision-making, avalanche problems. And one of the biggest things that we talk about is just how we as humans interact being outside and what mistakes we make.
Okay.
Being sort of humble in the mountains.
Yeah. So how much does it cost to do one of those 3-day courses?
$345.
Mm-hmm. Is there do you get out in the field?
Yep. It's more than half of your time is spent out in the field. So you have classroom sessions and some lecture time and activities, and then you're out being out there, learning how to observe the snow, test the snow, see how you travel through the snow.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to learn more about the classes and how you can sign up, there's a link to the Alaska Avalanche School on our website at alaskapublic.org. Just go down to where you see Avalanche Safety next to the Outdoor Explorer logo. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about avalanches today with Aleph Johnston Bloom, who's the director of the Avalanche School, and also with Kevin Wright, who's director of the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Information Center. I don't know how to put this the right way, but who's more likely to get in trouble out there? It seems like, just from my anecdotal memory of disasters that we've had, that people on snow machines seem to be more prone to get in trouble with avalanches in our region than people on skis. And I kind of wonder if that's because they're going faster, so they might notice fewer of the clues. If it's because of high marking where they're looking for steep slopes. Kevin, can you address that, the different user types and what kinds of different hazards they face?
Sure, yeah. This has actually been a pretty significant shift in recent years, just since technology with motorized use, with snow machines getting more and more powerful as well as lighter weight. It's gotten a lot easier for people on snow machines to get onto the steeper slopes in the backcountry. Where avalanches are likely to happen. And worldwide, definitely nationwide, the snow machine motorized user group has started taking a much larger percentage of the accidents and fatalities each winter as compared to skiers or non-motorized backcountry users. And, you know, there's a lot of smart people who are trying to figure out the reasons why and how to minimize the snow machiners getting into trouble. But it's a difficult problem. You know, like you were saying, when you're on a machine that can go 60, 80 miles an hour in the backcountry, it's a little bit more difficult to recognize some of those signs and symptoms of an unstable snowpack. And I think that is a big part of it. Just the general speed, being able to go fast, you know, you're not necessarily looking above you, looking around. You certainly can't hear anything. You can't hear the whooping sounds. You probably can't see the shooting cracks unless you're really, really cognizant of trying to notice little details like that.
So that seems like some of our big accidents have happened when there's a lot of people out too, and so people get the feeling, well, everybody else is out there, it must be okay.
Yep, you absolutely do see that. And one of the recent, semi-recent accidents that happened that was actually integral to the history of our avalanche center. A lot of people have been around for a while here in Alaska probably remember in 1999 in Turnagain Pass, there were 6 snow machiners killed in one event.
Yeah, awful.
And quite a few other people were witness to it.
You know, it was one of those sunny days when tons of people are out.
It was. Yeah. It was one of those sunny days where people simply couldn't resist the conditions. It's what we look for. It was a perfect powder day after a long storm had ended. So people had been cooped up at home for a week or two as it was storming. And then, as is typical, the sunny day, if it coincides with a weekend, everybody gets out there all at once, and they don't give the snowpack enough time to adjust to all that increased stress from the storm that had come through.
And you guys weren't doing your predictions or your warnings at that time?
There was no forecasting product available in 1999. And that kind of precipitated a lot of action with the Forest Service. And we actually got an appropriation through Senator Ted Stevens that kickstarted the whole project. And shortly thereafter, the Avalanche Center that we have now was incorporated and just started to build from there.
Mm-hmm. Aleph, do you have a different approach when dealing with people who are motorized? Because the clues, as Kevin were saying, are not as evident when you're on a motorized vehicle and compared to when you're skiing or snowshoeing.
Yeah, we do, and we've been developing our snow machine courses, and we have we've been doing them for a number of years, and really trying to expand that. But yeah, in some ways, it's recognizing similar things, but teaching about safe travel protocol and taking the time to look around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can't as
there's no substitute.
Yeah, but there are, you know, thinking about they're not going to be getting as much of like I'm feeling the snow in this way. So teaching sometimes to stop in places to look around so they can recognize that, or even, you know, ways that they can make their high marking, you know, safer by using better protocols.
Mm-hmm.
Not going out onto the slope to help your friend that's stuck, because then you're adding more weight to the slope. Things like that. Having your sled parked to be able to drive away and parked in a safe place while you're watching your friends. Things like that.
I mean, is high marking inherently kind of a dangerous activity? I mean, it seems like it's kind of pushing it to the edge. You guys are not wanting to answer this question, but it's a real, you know, it's a real thing.
It is, absolutely. You know, high marking, I totally understand the appeal. I've gotten into snow machining a little bit through my work, and it's a difficult skill to master.
There's tons of skill in riding a snow machine.
There's a huge amount of skill. So it's one of those ways where people can get out there and test their hill climbing abilities. And however, they're, you know, the act of putting a 400 or 500 pound sled with a rider, all that stress up onto a steep slope is exactly what you should be trying to avoid. In theory, if you're trying to avoid avalanches or triggering avalanches.
I mean, sometimes those tracks look like zippers on the snow, right? You know, like somebody installed a zipper up there.
Yeah.
So you have the two competing interests. You have somebody trying to get out there and have fun and test their own abilities, but you also have them doing the exact thing that could cause an avalanche to be triggered. Yeah.
And I guess there's some of that with backcountry skiing too. And I want to talk about more about that in the second half, about sort of finding this balance between, we don't want to scare people away, you know, because this is like the most beautiful, fabulous playground in the world, right? But we also want them to be safe and not to push their limits too far. And teaching people to find that limit, that's a challenging task. So it's a great topic today, avalanches on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. Kevin Wright is the director of the Avalanche Information Center at Chugach National Forest. Aleph Johnson Bloom is the director of the Alaska Avalanche School. And tons of information on the website and at Facebook. But right now, we're going to take time for the Outdoor Explorer calendar. Tonight, Thursday, December 12, there'll be a class on snowshoeing basics at REI in Anchorage from 6 to 7:30 p.m. This class is free and open to all ages. For more information, go to rei.com/Anchorage. And I've talked to the instructor. It sounds like a great class, and one of his lessons is snowshoeing is really easy with today's equipment, and everybody should give it a try. So check that out. Next item, everyone is invited to join the traditional archers of Alaska at the Carol Monch Archery Park in Chugach this Saturday, December 14th. There will be 20 3D animal targets set in actual hunting conditions. Only recurves, longbows, and primitive bows are allowed. It's $20 for adults and $15 for youth, including hot lunch. All kids 12 and under shoot free. Registration starts at 9:30 a.m. Shooting starts at 10:30 a.m. this Saturday, December 14th. For more info, go to traditionalarchersofalaska.com. This Sunday, December 14th, the Mat-Su Ski Club is hosting a moonlight ski tour. Ski under a full moon on the groomed trails at the Government Peak Recreation Area starting at 7 p.m. Those are the new trails that were just finished last year, and I know I'm looking forward to getting up there and trying them. For more info, go to matsuski.org. There will also be a moonlight ski in Anchorage, hosted by the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage. In the timing, you can do both. The Anchorage moonlight ski is on Monday, December 16th. And to tell us more about the Glen Alps moonlight ski, we have with us by phone Bob Sutherland from the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Charles. How are you today?
I'm great. So tell us about the moonlight ski. What are you guys going to do?
Well, we're going to meet up at the Glen Alps parking lot. Many people think of that as the Flat Top parking lot at 7 p.m. on Monday. And then we plan to ski to the German Club Bridge. And then we'll come back and expect to be back at the trailhead between 9 and 10 p.m. So 6 miles.
All right. So kind of following the route right up the valley there.
Yeah, right along the power line. Just right along the power line trail.
So is I assume we're coming up for full moon.
Yeah.
And hopefully the weather will be clear, because otherwise it'll be quite dark.
Well, I think right now the forecast is cloudy, but we get such bright moons that it's relatively clear. And I'm advocating that people bring headlamps in case we happen to need those too. It's always great to get out and ski, and evening skis are fun.
Uh-huh. What's the snow up there right now?
It's pretty hard pack and somewhat icy. We have a little storm rolling in this weekend, and we're anticipating to get a good snow. So all we need is a couple inches to cover that, and we'll have a great time. That snow that's there now, that's hard, it will be a great base for any new accumulation.
Uh-huh. Are you going to ski classic, or are you going to skate?
We always do on these backcountry tours, we always do classic.
Mm-hmm.
The exceptions are couple of springtime tours we have coming up in April.
But a lot of time you can skate up that route, right? I mean,
yes. It's an excellent crust ski come April. And, well, even if we get another set of rain, we just don't have enough snow right now for something like that. But it's we've even had all of us with fat bikes have been out there riding. So it's really, it can be a wonderful experience out.
I'm guessing it's probably pretty icy at the moment.
Yeah, it's crusty, icy, and we were saved at our last Turkey Day shakeoff tour by a snow that came in a few days beforehand, and I think we'll be saved again.
Uh-huh. So, Bob, what's your goal with doing this? Is it just try to introduce people to some beginning backcountry and point out to them they can get out of Kincaid and off Hillside, or what
yes.
are you trying? Yeah, okay.
Yes. We start out real simple and easy, like with that Turkey Day shake-off right after Thanksgiving, and then this full moon ski. It's a pretty easy flat ski out that power line trail. And then we have, we just start stepping it up. And so that people that haven't backcountry skied, haven't got out of town, and just stay on the groomed trails, if they start in on this, they can become an accomplished skier and have more enjoyable outdoor experiences. I think most people hike in the summertime. They get out, they go for walks, and I look at backcountry skiing as an extension to that. And I really think that we can go places that you can't go in the summertime because the snow often covers bushes and things like that. So it's actually better to get out then. So it's a natural progression, I think, from leaving town to go out and also with those developed skills and then also your hiking skills to get out where you've been hiking.
Yeah, it really opens up the world for you in the wintertime. And if you're just doing the power line just with a group, you don't really need to get true touring skis. You could really go out just with the regular classic skis you use at Kincaid or something.
Yes, any of those track skis or any ski actually will work. And we tune many of our skis to just a track ski or, you know, trail ski or something like that. You don't need metal edges. You mm-hmm. don't need anything fancy. We have on our Nordic Ski Club website, AnchorageNordicSki.com, there's a programs tab, and then the backcountry touring is in there. And we list the gear you need, and we list, we have something about Monday's tour, and it's kind of a cheat sheet to lead you right through it. So, you know, make sure you have the proper gear and, you know, you're warm and stuff mm-hmm. like that.
And it's basically open to everybody, and there's no fee, right?
Yeah, and there's no fee. We do require that people be a member of the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage.
Oh, okay.
And that's a $20 fee at that AnchorageNordicSki.com. They have application blanks there. That's for liability purposes, and your membership pays for our tours. And in turn, some of those tours, they're accompanied by the Anchorage Nordic Ski Patrol. They provide safety and assistance in case gear breaks or something goes wrong.
Well, and if you're skiing in Anchorage, you're using the facilities of the Nordic Ski Association because they groom all the trails. So you should pay anyway. Yep.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks very much. And what time are people meeting up there?
We're meeting at 7 o'clock again on Monday, December 16th at the Glen Alps Trailhead, the Glen Alps Trailhead. So show up a little bit early. If you got any questions, you can email me at AnchorageNordicSkiTours@gmail.com. And like I said, we're on the web at that AnchorageNordicSki.com. You can find us there, too.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Bob Sutherland. We'll have a link to the Glen Alps Moonlight Ski, as well as links to all the events mentioned on today's Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. And stay with us for the second half of the show, and we'll continue to talk about avalanche safety when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is avalanche safety. I have two guests in the studio. Kevin Wright is the director of the Avalanche Information Center, which is part of Chugach National Forest, and Aleph Johnson Bloom is with the Alaska Avalanche School. And we were talking earlier about finding this balance between adventure and thrills and still being safe. And I'm wondering, Aleph, when you're teaching, how do you avoid, on the one hand, just scaring people off, but at the same time, getting them to be conscious and knowledgeable what they're doing?
We really look at it as this way of basically empowering people to get out there because they now have this toolbox of knowledge and skill to choose what day to go, where to go, you know, what kind of people you want to go with, and so they can be more deliberate about being out in the mountains. Mm-hmm. They're not just like, I'm out, an avalanche might happen or it might not. It's more like, okay, I'm going here. I think the avalanche hazard is this because of, you know, I read the forecast or I've been paying attention to the weather, mm-hmm. and I'm going to put myself into the terrain in this way.
Mm-hmm. And how about you? How did you get into this? I assume you must be a skier or?
Yeah, I went to college in Arizona, and which is kind of funny. There's actually a terrific snow science program at this small outdoor college called Prescott College. Hmm. And took a class called backcountry skiing and basically shaped the rest of my life after that.
So like the first time you did it, it's just like, this is what I've got to do?
Yeah, and the combination of the problem solving and sort of intellectual part of figuring out snow really appealed to me. Mm-hmm. There was a class in college called avalanche forecasting, and from there have really just made that
made my career. So what do you do for fun in the wintertime?
I definitely try to get out on skis as much as possible. And, you know, I'm enjoying the Nordic skiing potential here. And I also do ride a snow machine as well and, you know, learning more about that.
Uh-huh. So, what kind of backcountry skiing do you do? Telemark or Rondelay?
I use alpine touring skis or Rondonet mm-hmm. skis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kevin, same question for you. I mean, you don't get into being an avalanche forecaster from, like, if you previously were, you know, working a desk job, I assume.
Yes, absolutely. I grew up right here in Anchorage. I was born and raised in town, and I went to college in Fairbanks. After that, I joined the Alyeska Ski Patrol, and I worked there for full-time for a number of years. And that's really what kind of got me into this career line. Certainly before I joined the Alaska Ski Patrol, I'd been a skier pretty much my entire life, including backcountry. And when I was young, when I was a teenager, I was skiing in the backcountry pretty much clueless as to the avalanche danger.
Mm-hmm. I've been there.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of us have kind of gone through that progression. And then fortunately through the ski patrol, a big focus of that is snow safety, keeping Alyeska, the ski area, safe from avalanches. And they have a huge, huge avalanche program on the mountain there. So I was just fully immersed in the whole world with that. I've also been a guide and a mountaineering ranger up on Mount McKinley. Mm. So pretty involved with the mountain rescue aspects and climbing big mountains. Just work and play. I'm quite often in the mountains.
Uh-huh. Well, when you go skiing for fun, where do you go?
Often the same places as where I work.
Okay.
Chugach National Forest, Chugach State Park, or Hatcher Pass.
Mm-hmm. Now it seems like in terms of this prediction thing, an awful lot of the backcountry use is concentrated in certain areas, especially like Turnagain Pass. Do you guys focus more at all on those areas where you know a lot of folks are going to be out? Or how do you address the fact that actually, I mean, Glen Alps would be another area. I mean, there's certain mm-hmm. spots where it's easy for people to get out. And so I would assume most of the avalanche risk is there because that's where most of the people who could be, you know, at hazard are located.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, here in Alaska, we have no shortage of mountains, but we actually do have a bit of a shortage of access to the mountains. Mm-hmm. And we find some of the best places for people to easily get up into the mountains for access, one of them would be Turnagain Pass. So we find a lot of use there. That's within the National Forest, of course. When we're talking about Glen Alps, that's Chugach State Park, mm-hmm. and then Hatcher Pass is also state land, a state recreation area.
Do your predictions apply to the whole sort of region or just to the National Forest?
Our predictions do not. It's actually, it's not specific to the land management issues. It's more of a microclimate weather issue. Mm-hmm. We found that the snowpack and the weather patterns you would find in the eastern Turnagain Arm, say Girdwood, Turnagain Pass, which is all Chugach National Forest, they're quite different than what you would find in the Front Range right here behind Anchorage and Chugach State Park. And that's different, again, from what you'd find in the Talkeetna Mountains of Hatcher Pass. So our avalanche forecasts that we produce specifically for Chugach National Forest should never be carried over and compared to what we're seeing in those other mountain ranges. Sure. It's completely different.
Interesting. And there's nobody doing predictions for those areas.
There are some volunteer groups who are working to create information products. But unfortunately, the state of Alaska, who manages those lands, has not been providing avalanche information for those areas for quite some time.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you either have to do it and predict all the time or not at all, because people not hearing a prediction might assume that that means that everything's fine.
Yes, we do find that the consistency is absolutely vital to creating a good product that people can rely on.
Mm-hmm. Aleph, what do you think of that Turnagain Pass area? Are there any particular hazards there that people should be aware of? Or, I mean, there's some pretty steep slopes there.
Yeah, you're pretty much, once you get out of the car and leave the road, you're almost always in some form of avalanche terrain. There are some places where you're in that lower angle terrain. And so that's one of the pieces that we are trying to teach folks to recognize. It's big terrain right off the road.
Right. And so you really do need to know what the heck you're doing. I mean, to some extent, it seems to me that if you're going to stay in low angle terrain, maybe you don't need to be as much of an expert as if you do. Yes?
Right. And that's one of the things we're trying to have people do is basically sort of ease into backcountry skiing. Mm-hmm. And so starting off that you're staying in those lower angle slopes and you're getting a feel for the snow and getting to look for clues. And then maybe if your actual skiing or snowboarding skill is there, then you're moving into avalanche terrain, but you're being deliberate about the days you go. So you're trying to choose days, looking at the forecast where there's lower hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we really encourage folks to look at the product for Turnagain Pass, the forecast product.
And the idea that you are going to risk being in an avalanche hazard area, but you're going to be able to ski fast enough or ride fast enough to get out of it, is just stupid, right?
Yes. Okay. I mean, to be blunt about it, yes.
I've heard people say that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think it's hard. It's confusing because there are...
And you see these videos.
There's
of people,
tons
right?
of movies out there, mm-hmm. and it's... I think one thing that people don't get to is that those are, A, pretty set up into what the consequences of some of those slopes mm-hmm. are. Like, it's pretty calculated to see what the runout is like, and they have snow safety professionals choosing their zones for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're also, professional skiers get into accidents and...
They get killed all the time.
Get killed or have serious injury.
Right, if you're watching a Warren Miller film, if you would jump off a 1,000-foot cliff, then go ahead, right?
And yeah. they're also phenomenal athletes, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think, but it's hard because it looks really fun and it's, you know, looks great. People want to do it. It's cool.
Skier porn is what I call it.
Yeah. And so that's kind of what we're almost combating in many ways, is that there's lots of really good skiers who live here in Anchorage mm-hmm. who their skiing skills are really high, but maybe their avalanche skills aren't matching up. And so we're... Mm-hmm. hoping people can kind of help bring those things together.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. Our topic today, obviously, is avalanches. I'm Charles Woolforth. You just heard from Aleph Johnston Bloom. Kevin Wright is also with me. All right, you're headed out. You've got your knowledge. You've taken your class. What should you have in your backpack heading into avalanche country? Kevin?
Every time you go out, and everybody in the party needs to have some basic pieces of equipment. And among those would be an avalanche transceiver or a beacon, a shovel and a probe, and then, of course, the knowledge and skills and practice to be able to use those quickly and efficiently. The avalanche beacon is very specific to what it is. It's not the same as a personal locator beacon or some of the other products that are out there. They're widely available. But yeah, basically those three items, the beacon, shovel, probe, everybody has to have it every time.
Mm-hmm. And how much would you spend to get ready, to get outfitted?
How much money for those items?
Yeah.
A beacon's usually in the ballpark of $350, a shovel and a probe, maybe $50 to $70 each. So it's a small investment. But if you don't have any of these items, the chance of digging your partner out alive are extremely low.
Mm. And everybody needs a beacon. It's not like one is enough. So explain how the beacon works. And is it? And I've heard that there's some new technology, that these things are getting better or more usable, yes?
They are getting better. There's a lot of research and development going on to improve the search technology. The beacon, so when you go out into the backcountry, you wear a beacon somewhere on your body underneath your clothes, and it transmits a signal all the time, all day when you're out there on 457 kilohertz. So it's basically beeping. You can't hear it unless you're listening on a receiving beacon. So the theory is if somebody gets caught in an avalanche and buried, then they have a transmitting beacon on them, and the rescue team, which would be the other skiers or other group in that party, would then go into rescue mode, and they would pull out their beacons and switch them to receive and search for that signal until they can pinpoint the location of the buried person.
Then and is it going to like have a pointer that, or is it going to beep more when you get closer? How does that work?
There's both audible and visual indicators. Mm-hmm. So you'll hear a beeping sound, and you'll also be able to look on it. Most of them have a distance indicator, so it tells you you're 20 meters away. As you get closer, it'll dial down 10 meters, 5 meters, 3 mm-hmm. meters, and so forth.
And it's same rig for a snow machiner and for a skier? Any difference?
There's no difference. Same essential equipment mm-hmm. for both groups.
So, Aleph, there's been an avalanche, and you've now got like 30 minutes. The person probably won't be alive if it takes more than half an hour to find them, yes?
Correct.
Okay.
Maybe much less than that.
Right. So go through the process of what you're and one thing we didn't mention is obviously none of this will work if you go by yourself.
Correct.
You know, we said the brain was most valuable, but tool, but you're going to need more than one brain.
Or not, right. Or and the other part is if your entire group is buried mm-hmm. together, then you also won't, this also
mm-hmm.
won't work.
Mm-hmm. Right. Larger the group, the more people there are to look for you if you get in trouble.
Right. But yeah. Also only putting one person in harm's way at a time mm-hmm. is really important.
Right. Okay. So walk us through it. Someone's been buried.
You first look to make sure there's no additional hazard, and that's kind of complicated because if there is, you have to decide if you want to go risk your own life.
Mm-hmm.
You switch your beacon to...
Now, just on that one, I would think that if there's been an avalanche, then this slope should be pretty stable because it's gone now, right?
But if there's adjacent slopes that could mm-hmm. actually slide into that area or pieces of snow left over, which we call hang fire, mm-hmm. you could trigger that as well.
Okay.
And especially since an avalanche just happened, you know that there is unstable snow in that area.
Right. Now, there's some pictures, and just not to interrupt you, but there's some pictures on the website where it looks like a slab has come down, and then there's sort of this zipper at the top. Is that a place where you're talking about hang fire that could come down on top of that avalanche?
Yeah, especially looking at kind of mm-hmm. the snow both to the right and the left mm-hmm. of the top of that area.
Right.
Some of that snow could potentially come to where the rescuers
right.
are working.
So for listeners, we're talking about the second photo down on the website if you want to take a look at what Aleph's talking about. All right, so you've sussed that out.
Yeah, you've decided to search. So you switch your transceiver or your beacon to receive. And maybe you're lucky right when you turn it on that you get a signal right away. The whole time, too, you're hopefully have been watching and you've seen wherever your party member is. You have a last seen point, mm-hmm. but you're moving in that direction and you're trying to cover the entire slope. Basically, like your beacon is a spotlight. So I would say my beacon has about a 10-meter spotlight in either direction around me. So I'm moving back and forth, covering the whole slope with my spotlight, trying to find a signal mm-hmm. if I don't have one. Once I pick up a signal, then
I'm... Is the depth that the person's buried going to affect how far the signal will propagate?
Yes. Just, yeah. I mean, it's a...
So if they're way down there, they're much harder to find.
Yep.
Okay.
It's harder, for sure. And so you're moving along, and once I get a signal, I'm following... You know, I've picked up that radio frequency, and I'm following my beacon, looking at the lights, the sounds, in and as I'm going in, the numbers are decreasing, the sounds may pulse louder depending on whatever kind of beacon I have. Mm-hmm. And I get there, and I'm essentially pinpointing an area, finding a zone that is where I think they are, the closest number I can get. And then I get my probe out, and I'm actually probing into the snow to locate them with my probe. And then I'm shoveling. And
so
I'm,
you don't start shoveling until you've made positive contact
right.
with the probe.
Because the idea that you could move, if I dig in the wrong place, I could move tons of snow that and not find the person mm-hmm. and waste a lot of time. And so just recently in the last five years or so, they've really been, in classes, we've been really stressing shoveling effectively as well. So you're not wasting time. Because if you have that, you know, 15 to 30 minute window, you got to do all of that as fast as you can.
Mm-hmm. So shoveling effectively, not digging too big of a hole, you mean? Or
Things like not digging straight down to your buried friend because you could collapse their air pocket. And if I tunnel down and I get to their foot, then and I'm not near their head, it's really, it will take a bunch more time for me to get to their head. So we're actually starting a little bit down the slope, about 1.5 times the depth that they're buried, and we're digging up and into them so we can get to them efficiently and have a good platform to deal with medical issues.
I see. And if you're digging from below, I guess it's easier to get rid of the snow as you
yep.
dig.
So you don't shovel twice,
mm-hmm.
and you're
mm-hmm.
actually on your knees, you know, shoveling, moving snow as fast as you can.
So you find the person. Are they usually conscious when you find them?
And that's so, I mean, it's incredibly
diverse,
situationally
yeah.
dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, yes, and ideally they haven't been injured by trauma. And I think that's the other piece is that being in an avalanche can be incredibly traumatic. You can hit objects. You can mm-hmm. just be twisted around. So I do think one of the things that people think beacons do is protect you, and in many ways it's just a location device. It's not an avalanche talisman that says mm-hmm. I'm safe now.
Right. And it almost goes without saying, but not quite, that if you're taking the beacon out of the blister pack when the first time you have to use it, you're probably not going to use it very well. You need to really practice with it yeah. before you get out there, right?
Yeah, and it's something both, I think I also have a ski patrol background, and on ski patrol, you practice so regularly that you really, that's really illuminated that it's hard to be really good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to practice, and you have to practice in realistic situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which I guess would build your awareness and thinking about
yeah.
the fact that this has to be on top of mind. Kevin, I've heard about new products like sort of some kind of flotation thing that can be inflated. You're suddenly in avalanche, and I don't know how this works, but... Are you aware of that, and what is it, and do you think it works?
Yes, it's relatively new technology, but it's actually it's become fairly common, and there's some pretty good research that it does actually work. So what it is, an avalanche airbag backpack is what you're looking for, and the theory behind it is you have a trigger system, basically a rip cord. It's accessible. So if you do get caught in an avalanche, you pull the ripcord, and back behind your head, out of the backpack, a large air bladder will inflate from a compressed gas cylinder. And it basically offers flotation when you're in the moving snow. it offers flotation to carry you to the surface or keep you on the surface of that moving snow. So when the snow comes to a stop, you should be at the surface rather than being buried underneath. Hmm. And they are quite effective. They've been doing research on how well they work. And
but it wasn't something you listed as a requirement. Aleph, what's your thought on it?
Well, I think it's just it's really interesting, and I just actually read a little article about it last mm-hmm. night that had some more information. I think there is research that it's effective, but only in sort of specific terrain mm-hmm. and things like, you know, if you're dragged through the trees or if you're at the bottom of a gully, all those things, you know, it's not effective all right. the time. And the other thing that...
You don't want it to give you a false sense of security.
And that's one yeah. of the things that I think a lot of professionals worry about is mm-hmm. that people think that once I have all this equipment, I will right. be safe. Again, like, that same
you have,
way.
You have a cell phone, so you don't need to know yeah. where you are, that kind of effect. So we're almost out of time, but have either of you ever been in an avalanche? Have you ever been a victim of an avalanche? Can you tell us about that, Kevin?
Sure. I'd say that I've witnessed more than I've actually been caught in myself. But I guess one of the situations was right up here behind Anchorage in the Peak 3 area. And I wasn't hurt at all, but it was one of those big surprises for me when I was out there in the spring, great weather day, and as I was skinning up the slope, going up on my skis, I popped a slab that actually propagated pretty far out in front of me and took a sizable slab with it. It carried me for just a very short distance. I wasn't buried or anything like that, but the size of it was significant, and the debris pile that continued down the mountain was large enough that bystanders actually did some searching in it to make sure that nobody was caught or buried.
Is that a learning experience for you?
Absolutely. You know, every time you see something like that, it's a huge, huge learning experience. And you replay the events and think about all the signs that you missed mm-hmm. With the stability
and
issues.
I would think just the physical sensation of setting it off and knowing what that's like
it's pretty interesting. Yeah. A lot of adrenaline starts flowing when you see just tons of snow start moving you caused.
Well, great. This has been fascinating. I want to thank both of you. Kevin Wright, director of the Avalanche Information Center, Aleph Johnston-Bloom of the Alaska Avalanche School, and Bob Sutherland was with us earlier talking about the Glen Alps Moonlight Ski. And you can find out all the additional information you might want to know to connect to those organizations at our website at alaskapublic.org. Next week on Outdoor Explorer, the topic is winter biking. This is another Alaskan innovation, and a lot of the best equipment is coming from here. We'll cover everything, equipment, commuting, and even cross-country expeditions. Check in on Facebook at Outdoor Explorer to learn more or to join the discussion. Thank you for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Kristen Platt, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.